Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
We're really lucky, Lucy Bryars and I, because this is the only dressing room that has a kitchenette and its own bathroom.
Nice.
There's a quote printed in the loo that says, "It is a right royal building with a theatrical tradition fit for a king," which is a quote that's been printed, and underneath it, Ian McKellen has signed it, King Lear 2018. So what I'm going to do when I leave is take a Sharpie and say, "Fit for a king, dot, 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 and queen."
Absolutely.
And write, yeah. Hayley Atwell.
Hi, I'm John Wilson. Welcome to These Three, a series in which I talk to artists, musicians, writers, directors, actors, photographers, all sorts of creative people, in fact, about their artistic lives by focusing on three key works, one that they made themselves, that they're particularly proud of, one by somebody else that they wish they'd made, and one that they're working on right now.
Hello, I'm Hayley Atwell, and I'm going to be telling you a little bit about a role I've played, a role I wish I'd played, and a role I'm currently playing.
Hayley Atwell is in her dressing room in a London West End theatre, preparing for tonight's performance of Rosmer's Home, a late 19th century play by Henrik Ibsen, all about love, grief and political turmoil. More of that later when we discuss the role I'm playing. Hayley, welcome to this
programme. Thank you for having me. Welcome to my dressing room.
You're here in a theatre today, but if we stepped out from the stage door of the Duke of York's and headed round to one of the many cinemas here in the West End, of course you could see Hayley in the biggest film of the year, Avengers Endgame, of course, in which Hayley plays Agent Peggy Carter, a super spy, a love interest of Captain America. We've also seen her on screen in the remake of Brideshead Revisited, The Duchess, the recent adaptation of Andrea Levy's The Long Song. A lot of period dramas.
I know. Well, I'm a big fan of adaptations of books. I love literature, and it just so kind of happens that I'm naturally gravitate towards projects and people whose work kind of stems from a piece of literature. And so inevitably, a lot of that has ended up being period dramas. I have, though, I have to say, I loved being in Black Mirror. And that was something that I felt was so different to any kind of genre I've done before.
The Charlie Brooker series.
Yeah, and I got to wear jeans. It was just so exciting.
Was that a first for you on screen?
On screen it was, yeah. So even when I got Captain America, I thought, oh, brilliant, superhero, completely different thing than the period dramas I've done before. And of course, it's set in the 40s, my one. So
there is still exactly. Period. You're wearing an army uniform.
Yes, it's from the 1940s.
1940s,
exactly.
So, yeah. But of course, you were in Black Mirror. And I remember the one where the boyfriend dies and she's hanging on to him and trying to reimagine him or wish him back into this world.
Yeah, using it was called Be Right Back, and it was using technology that simulates him and as a supposedly grieving tool, but of course it means that she can't quite move on, and the robot version of him becomes so lifelike that it's very hard for her to kind of discern between reality and this kind of suspended reality that she's living in with him, unbeknownst to the rest of the world. So it's quite dark, but kind of a beautiful, poignant study on grief. And I think Charlie Brooker, and I contacted them directly after seeing the first series and went, I have to be involved in this in some way. It's so original. So
not only a lot of period dramas, a lot of grief on your CV as well.
Grief. I know, for someone who hasn't experienced that.
I mean, we'll talk about Rosmer's Home, but it's there in Captain America as well, isn't it? About love
loss.
And loss.
absolutely. The loss of a loved one, how to process grief with dignity in the hope that it will eventually be transformed into something of use or of purpose, and that you can become integrated into who you are and part of what defines choices that you make, that it hopefully will kind of humanizes people and pacifies people in a way that makes them more empathetic.
What has Avengers done for you, just in terms of profile and the roles that you can take, the roles that you're being offered? I guess also the audience that's coming here to see Ibsen every night. Are you noticing quite a younger audience coming?
It's so lovely to see and to meet people, and I always go outside afterwards to sign, because I love to see who is it that's coming to see this. And I'm so happy that so many of them have been Marvel fans that have not particularly interested or know of Ibsen's work or theatre, but are captivated by this. And they're talking about Endgame, but they're talking about the effects that this play has on them. And although some of the ideas are politically quite complex, they're philosophical at times, religion comes into it. This might not be subjects of interest to them, especially because this was set 134 years ago, but they're still relating to the human nature, the human relationships that a lot of these arguments kind of live out through. And that's really wonderful to see, because I love theatre, I love this world. I'm probably more comfortable here than anywhere else, really. It's kind of feel like what I've been trained for. So to be part of a franchise so beloved that still comes and finds me in the jobs that I'm doing,
bringing a new audience to theatre, younger audience in particular.
Yeah, yes, exactly. I think I'm very grateful to Marvel, continue to be, of that I get to portray a character that is wholesome, that is not over-sexualized, that is not too much of one thing, that she seems to be independent, knows her own mind.
She's super smart.
And super smart, exactly. And so to have those qualities kind of follow me around that other men and women and boys and girls have attributed to and have sought some kind of inspiration from, it's beautiful. It's a lovely thing. It's a real kind of gift that I'm very grateful to.
And theatre, you say, is your comfort zone. So here we are in a dressing room. We're a couple of hours, 2 or 3 hours before curtain up. Is there a ritual? Is there a sort of a certain routine that you have to go through? Are you superstitious?
I'm not superstitious. I know that much. And I don't have a particular ritual for every job that I do. It very much depends on the atmosphere that's created in a rehearsal room. I feel great work happens when the ensemble is bigger than the individual parts. And so we play volleyball in the auditorium every day. And really silly games.
Every day.
Every day before. 6 p.m. to 6:30 is a volleyball. We put a net up in the seat, by the seats.
That's fantastic. Your director's Ian Rickson. Is that his thing? Does he bring the ball in?
Yeah, it's his thing. It's also our stage manager, Ben Delfont, who's brilliant at it. You always kind of want to be on his team because he's so good at it. But it's a great way of kind of, it wakes us all up, gets kind of the competitive spirit going. More than anything, I think any rituals I have is rituals about freedom, freeing the voice, freeing my body, being out of my own head, not being too much in my own ego or any kind of fear-based perspectives on wanting to, you know, to do a good job that night. So just kind of getting out of your own personality, really, and kind of shaking off the day and coming into a dressing room like this just to be in the space. And it's nothing too serious and it's nothing too kind of, you know, earnest. It's just being being alive to it and be receptive to it.
Right, come on, three roles. And we're going to start with the role I played. Chances are it's going to be a period drama.
Yes, of course. Well, I thought about Black Mirror, but I kept on coming back to this one, which is Margaret Schlegel in Ian Forster's Howard's End. And we did a television adaptation of it, adapted by the remarkable writer Kenny Lonergan, probably most recently known for his Oscar-winning director and writer of Manchester by the Sea, and also many, many plays. He adapted this beautiful book. He didn't watch the film. He went directly to the book again. I mean, this is an adaptation of a book, not a retelling of the film. And when the call came in to do it, for me, the period drama aspect of it was honestly a little bit of a turn off. just because I really want to be accessible to people who are not necessarily gravitating towards period dramas. So how do I get, you know, how do I break through the endless, binded, corseted, stuffy, uptight versions of period dramas that can leave me quite cold, you know, that feel too mannered? And when I met with Hetty McDonald, the director, and we spoke with Kenny Lonergan about it, it was very kind of clear from the beginning the how fine this piece of work was and how humanitarian it was and how E.M. Forster wrote this extraordinary woman. He chose Margaret Schlegel as a character that expresses his ideas. And I have it on my phone here. I just want to make sure I get it right. The quote, the very famous quote that many people will know of Margaret Schlegel is the quote, "Only connect." That was the whole of her sermon. "Only connect the prose and the passion and both will be exalted and human love will be seen at its height. Live in fragments no longer." Ultimately, it's the moving towards each other,
yeah.
And opening up a dialogue that begins with one's differences to the other person. And when we did Howard's End, it felt particularly resonant because with social media and the political climate at the time and still where we're at the moment, there was just constant warring of both sides.
When was it?
It came out 2017. And it was nominated for BAFTA for Best Series. So it had great acclaim, but unfortunately, because of the channel in the States that it was on, very few people saw it. So regardless of that, though, the piece itself for me was absolutely what I was saying before about the attempt to go beyond myself. You know, Margaret Schlegel is not someone I have any sort of connection with. Born into this Edwardian world where it's very much kind of the idealistic, romantic idea of England just before the First World War, and you have Margaret at the head of this family, and she is trying to combine the intellect and emotion. And she is courted by Henry Wilcox, who is a businessman, a capitalist, and seemingly to be all his values seem to be completely opposite hers. But she comes to love him, and in loving him, she's living out what she believes, which is to go towards people. Mm. And there's one moment in it that I found was so kind of profound selflessness and maturity. She asks him to do a kindness to her for her sister. And her sister finds herself pregnant out of wedlock. And she goes to her husband and says, you know, will you let us stay at Howard's End tonight with my sister while we work out our best to look after her? And he refuses. And his initial reaction is that it would be shameful, that if anyone realized that he was housing a woman pregnant out of wedlock, that it would look bad on him. And in that moment, his character of being someone that is entirely obsessed with his own reputation and status, that she realizes that he does not have the integrity or the morality or the compassion or the empathy that she has and that she looks for in others. So she realizes that, you know, she has to walk away. But in doing so, she still excludes him. And that's also against her belief system.
Mm.
So the story is very much like, how can you still be true to yourself, but still continue to walk towards people who seemingly are working against your core values? And how can you make peace with that person? And how can you find common ground? And so I thought it's a very elegant and emotionally mature story. And we kind of, like, you know, so on set, we're going, God, we'd all love to be a little bit like Meg. So it's like she's constantly reaching out, trying to be beyond her own limited thought system. And I found that to be very inspiring and hopeful. But she believes in the strength of kindness.
Is it hard to play people that you really dislike? I mean, you haven't actually played many disreputable or unlikable characters.
I've just started. So here's my kind of changing trajectory of the work. And I think for me, this, as an actor, becomes a bit of a mark of maturity, that I'm no longer just interested in playing the good characters. But it's why I took The Long Song, that Andrea Levy beautiful book that she'd written, and we made it as she was very ill, and it came out just before she passed away.
And you were playing the plantation
owner, the slave owner.
Well, she is the owner, isn't she? She's the sister of the guy who's inherited.
She has no rights or wealth of her own, again, like Rebecca West, but she is a product of her time. And on the page, because she's told through the narrative of our heroine, who is a slave and the maid of this, my character, she's told in slightly, I suppose at moments, kind of hysterical, caricature, kind of monstrous, almost pantomime ugly sister. And on the reading of it, I thought, I don't know how to play this. She's so grating on the page. But the challenge was for me, I think also having played someone like Margaret, it was so refreshing to then go and play someone who was the opposite, who was so woefully ignorant.
And was that interesting to play then? I mean, given that you have played strong and upstanding and a lot of nice women in the past, to play this person who is quite awful.
Quite awful. And that's necessary in terms of stretching yourself as an actor. I think, you know, we limit ourselves by if we say, you know, I only want to play characters that I like or that other people like or that seem to be socially acceptable or are just the heroes.
So back to the next role.
Yes.
Well, Howard 10, I mean, that's something that clearly you are very proud of.
Mm.
Do you look very often at other people's performances and think, I should have done it like that, I wish I could do something like that?
No, like in theatre, you know, when you go, just because Judy, our dear Judy, did the most, I think, one of the most, probably the best Lady M that I've ever seen, which we can still get. Trevor Nunn's production of Ian McKellen.
Mm.
By the way, that bed there in the corner was donated by Ian McKellen when he did Lear in here. It's just a little side note anecdote.
He brought the bed in and left it,
so I'm very grateful
really?
To him. I get to nap.
That is the McKellen bed.
Yeah. It's so cute. I just get such a kick out of that still. But just, you know, because Judy's done that doesn't then mean that...
You can't have a go.
We can't, no, because that's what's great about... I think that's also the generosity of more of the theatre world and actors. They go, you want to have a bash at that. Like we all, you know, a lot of the guys will want to have their Iago moment or the Hamlet or whatever it is. And a lot of women would often say, I want to have my, you know, the Thérèse Raquin or the Cleopatra or the whatever it is. And so that's all kind of in the canon. And you want to have a go at it.
You haven't done Lady M, have you?
Not yet. I'd like to play Iago, actually, now that we're in a slightly more modern era of gender swapping.
Can I just ask you something, though? You said Lady M. Is that on purpose? Is that because you are a little bit superstitious?
Oh, do you know what?
I'm
not going to say it. I'll tell you one reason why. We were discussing, I did a play at Hampstead two years ago called Dry Powder, and we were talking about how we weren't superstitious. And just before the matinee, one of the other actors just said it. And he went, see? And I kid you not, in the matinee, there were these revolving, they looked like giant Toblerones, but they're made of mirrors. And one of them fell over and smashed, and there was glass all over the stage. Yeah. And I was just like, that's just annoyingly weird.
Like, if people don't understand the word we're talking about, I'm not going to say it, obviously, because
it's a Scottish play. But we're in the theatre, but the superstition is.
The one who wants to be king with the ambitious wife. We all know what we're talking about now. But,
yeah, exactly.
So that actually happened, and now...
It's not so much superstition, it's a respect of the ritual of... Just as a group of, we don't say that.
And
it's
I said it in front of Simon Russell Beale once in the National Theatre.
And what does he do?
He made me walk out.
Oh, yeah, what? Yeah.
I had to walk out the door. I had to then knock and ask permission to come in. I then had to turn around three times in front of him and spit on the floor. That was his way of overcoming the thing, because it slipped out. And as soon as I said it, I said, oh, shit, I'm not supposed to say that, am I?
Yeah.
And I said, are you okay? And he went, no, I'm not okay. I'm really not okay. And we had to do this.
I love that.
Brilliant.
I love that. Well, I think there is power in a belief of something like that. There is power. If we give superstition power, I think it weirdly takes on a kind of a bit of a force of its own. So I believe in the power that we have to create superstition.
Right. Okay, let's move on.
Yeah.
The role you wish you'd played.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Anytime, any place, any role, anywhere, film, stage, television, whatever.
Well, the first one came to mind and I went, yeah. And then I looked at some other ones and I just kept on going back to this. It has to be Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And is it a film that you watched a lot as a kid?
No, not really. I think I've probably seen it about three times. And the first time I got it, I went, oh, I don't like her. She's horrible and spoilt and petty and petulant and is really mean to the lovely Olivia de Havilland. When you're revisiting it now, of someone who knows a little bit more about character arcs and character development, analysing it from that point of view, where Vivien Leigh's performance begins, and in the space of, what, 3.5 hours, 4 hours even, maybe, what she undergoes. It's ultimately a story of survival and how adversity forges character. And it's on the backdrop of a period of time which I find so fascinating and a dark part of America's past that it still has to reckon with and hasn't fully healed. And, of course, the backdrop of the Civil War. So, and my family and my father's side are all from the Midwest.
Oh, you're half American, aren't you?
Yeah, so they're originally from Kansas City. So growing up there, and when I was younger, there's the stories of the South and the stories of the Midwest and coming over the Santa Fe Trail and in a wagon. You know, that was all part of kind of stories that my family would tell me about where we had come from.
And those stories had been passed down. They were real stories that had gone down through the generations.
Through letters and how...
Wow, pioneers. There's a
myth within the family that during the Civil War, an ancestor of mine was given land as payment for serving, but it was a bit of land on Catalina Island, which at that time had nothing on it and was off the coast of California. And then he gambled it in a poker game, lost it. And I love stories like that. It's so different to kind of, you know, me growing up in London in the 80s.
Yeah.
You know,
where did the family come from, that American side? Where were they travelling from through the Midwestern?
They were English, but had...
So it was English originally?
English originally, okay. Yeah. And then travelled and then got on a wagon and travelled the Santa Fe Trail, and most of them settled in Kansas City. And I would spend my summers there, and I could hear the sound of an old train go by where my grandmother lived, and the sight of lightning bugs and the smell of the humidity, which is so particular. There's like this sweet humidity in Kansas City that is so nostalgic for me. And when I watch things like Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe, it reminds me of an Americana and a nostalgia for it that was so enthralling to me as a kid from urban London in the 1980s. So Gone with the Wind absolutely ticked all those boxes for me. And I was, when I was actually filming Endgame, I was in Atlanta, which of course is where Margaret Mitchell, who wrote Gone with the Wind, was from and wrote the book. So on my day off, I went to the house that she wrote the book in, which is now a museum. And there's a museum next door to it. And then you can go and tour the house and you can see the little corner by the window and the typewriter that she used.
And you've read the book, of course.
Yeah. And having read the book and gone, this woman wrote this over a period of 3 years because she had an ankle injury. And she was, her very devoted husband, who was also a writer, would come home every day with all these library books for her to kind of devour, weighed down by the heaviness of all these books. And so one day he just came back with a typewriter and he went, just write a book instead. So she wrote Gone with the Wind.
Amazing.
And she was so embarrassed about doing it because she hadn't written a novel before, that she would, every time guests would come in and unannounced, she would just hide pages of it under like coffee tables or under a couch cushion. And of course, you know, she goes on to win the Pulitzer, and within the space of a year, it's picked up and it's going to be made into this epic film. And it was made in 1939 at a time when America, having suffered in depression, is now also the European threat of World War II happening. It was a very kind of tumultuous time. And to have this kind of great sweeping epic and have this heroine at the centre of it, who ultimately, this goes back to why I would love to have played her, is that she's just this kind of force unto herself. You know, she's petulant, she's petty, but she's still so stubborn and strong-willed and awful, but kind of like so unashamedly bad to the people around her. And I kind of think that I love the almost the freedom of that. You know, as a child, I was very concerned with being doing the right thing and not upsetting other people. And if I did misbehave, if I was reprimanded from it by a teacher or if I'd hurt someone, I would be beside myself, overly sensitive about if I'd done something bad. But it also stopped me from kind of rebellion. I didn't really rebel. And yet you have a character like Scarlett O'Hara who's so deeply self-interested and kind of ignores the guidance of the extraordinary women around her, Mamie and also her mother, who's like this kind of pillar of integrity and morality. And then she, because of extreme adversity and losing everything, that's when the real character is forged. And she's saying things like, you know, tomorrow is another day, and as God is my witness, I'll never go hungry again. And then
great lines.
And it's great, these, you know, and I love a bit of the epic. There's something kind of, I'm big into the big emotions and the big drama.
She won Oscar. Did she win the Oscar for it as well?
Yeah, she did. And she also fought for it. There was 1,400 people that were seen for it. They spent $100,000 on searching for the right Scarlett O'Hara.
1,400 auditions for Scarlett?
1,400, yeah, of unknowns. Catherine Hepburn was it. She really wanted it, but...
Was she married to Laurence Olivier at the time? Or was that
Vivien Leigh was, yeah. I think, yeah.
They were married at the time,
so.
Weren't they?
But she was kind of unknown. And I think I also, what I love about her is that even at the end, when he goes, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, she still...
It's the director. This is Ian Rickson walking in on the interview, the director of Roswell's Home.
Yes, come on,
Home.
We need to do the notes.
Yes,
oh, you're doing notes
at 5
now?
5 p.m.
Thanks, John.
15 minutes.
Thank you, Ian. She'll be there.
I think what I love about her is that even at the end when he says, you know, Frank, my dear, I don't give a damn, you get this kind of sense that she's always going to be okay because of what she's had to develop within herself in order to survive. So I just think it's an extraordinary trajectory of a person. And also, everyone speaks so fast. And it's just, I'm just thinking, like, the energy it would have taken in order to sustain that amount of...
You could have coped with that, though.
I think so. I'm a very fast talker.
You do speak very fast.
I know, I do.
You've packed a lot in. Now I'm aware that the director is banging on the door and saying, hurry up, we are going to have to move on to the role I am playing. Which is self-evident, because we're here at the Duke of York's Theatre with the director banging on the door saying he wants to give you notes for Roswell's Home. Mm. And we mentioned it at the beginning. Mm. Very rarely performed Ibsen play. Mm. I saw it the other week when you just started the run. I was absolutely knocked away by this play because I knew nothing about it. Mm. It's a tough piece, and it speaks to today, strangely enough, even though it's, 140 years old?
134 years old. I had not heard of the play, and very few people I know had heard the play, let alone not been even able to pronounce it. Roshmerbaum, Schlobbertosch.
It's the home of Rosmer. That's the way to remember it. Rosmer's home.
Rosmer's home. Ibsen wrote this after 27 years of self-imposed exile, doing all his writing in either Munich or Italy. And he comes back to Norway and he discovers what he perceives to be kind of a sham democracy. And he believes that in order to move civilization forward, it is about ennobling the workers and the women. So he writes Roswell's Home. And it's seldom performed, despite the fact that Ibsen is the second most performed playwright in the world after Shakespeare. And that he's so well known for his heroines like Hedda Gabler and Nora and A Doll's House. Duncan Macmillan had adapted it. Ian Rickson was going to direct it. Sonia Friedman was producing it. Tom Burke was playing Rosmer. And it was just like, ding, 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 ding.
And another very strong female part at the centre of this play. Mm. So you are Rebecca West, and she is the former best friend of the wife of Rosmer, who has died. And we understand over the course of the play how she's died and the circumstances. Mm. But there is clearly a romantic and, well, actually a sexual tension between Rebecca and Rosmer himself. But then all this political turmoil going on outside.
Yeah.
I mean, it's chiming with what's going on at the moment, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Well, it talks about the press being responsible for what it feeds people. You have Rosmer, who is the seat of power in this town. And up until this point, he's kind of been politically neutral. But you kind of know from his friends and the name of Rosmer that they're slightly more right-leaning. They're very much in tradition. And you have his brother-in-law called Kroll, who has become a governor, and he wants to try and influence Rosmer because he knows that there are so many undecided voters in this great general election that's about to happen that Rosmer really will be able to impact lots of people who still yet to vote and decide. And so he's trying to push him into this more traditional way of upholding the social conditions of the time.
because he was seen as a very highly moral man, a man of great upstanding at the centre of
society. He was also the town's pastor.
He's a pastor, of course, yeah.
And what we also discover, though, is that when his wife killed herself, he also, around that time, not only resigned from being a pastor, but renounced his faith. So since the suicide, he's been undergoing a personal crisis of identity and doesn't quite know how to fill that existential void now. Of course, you know, Ibsen was influenced by people like Nietzsche and Sartre, so existentialism was around, God, the idea of God is dead, Marxism was around. So Rosmer's kind of battling with all of these things. And then you have this third power, this force, which is Rebecca West. What we know about her is the confidant of the wife who then killed herself. She stayed in this house for this last year since Beth has died. We don't quite know why. What's she doing there? Mm-hmm. But she seems to have had this kind of relationship with Rosmer. It was a meeting of kind of minds. There's a lot of, it's sexually charged, but they've never even touched or acknowledged that there is kind of passion there. And she is self-educated. She is radical. She's a free thinker. Rosmer has given her freedom to be herself. So they engage in lots of debate. And what you realise is that Rebecca is trying to push Rosmer towards the left. And so you've got Kroll pushing him one way, Rebecca pushing the other. And the obstacle, of course, between them is that Rebecca and Rosmer are in love. And so they're almost, their love really complicates matters. You know, at some point, Kroll says, you know, I don't know what I'm looking at. And Rosmer later on says, I don't know what I'm looking at. And there's the big conflict, or the question is, did she lead a woman to her death, or has she just confessed to something that wasn't true in order to sacrifice herself to help a man be relinquished of his own guilt? Some nights feel it swings more one way than the other.
So you never know yourself entirely?
No.
You can play it in different ways?
Yeah, it's often how it ends up telling itself through how we as an ensemble, you know, if there's a particularly strong night for Kroll, whose arguments land in a particular way that can make Rebecca feel very vulnerable or threatened, it might empower her to fend herself more. And then there are other times when I almost feel that she is much more Machiavellian. And the audience is kind of up to them what they make of her. There was a man that I met outside the stage door, and he came back the next day, he's like, do you think she's telling the truth when she confesses to what she supposedly confesses to? And I go, that's for you to decide. I know it's really frustrating,
wow.
But that's what's, I think, the genius of what Ibsen did, is that he's taken a heroine like Rebecca and gone, we're making her ambiguous because human beings are. Are we ever entirely innocent? Are we ever entirely guilty? Do we ever really know ourselves?
But isn't it great that those ambiguities can be played out in different ways every night? That's why the theatre is so great.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Let's have you all up to Jake and Peter's dressing room, please.
That's it.
Jake and Peter's dressing room. Thank you.
That's notes.
Hayley, fantastic to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And if you enjoyed Hayley Atwell, listen out for other episodes featuring the likes of Paul Weller, Tom O'Dell, Jonathan Yeo, Lucy Prebble, Kwame Kwayama, Guy Garvey, and there are many more on the way. Please do rate and review these three. It helps other people find the series. And subscribe so that you don't miss an episode. Also, have a look at the website. We've got more information about all of the guests. There are photographs, videos, previews of forthcoming episodes. We're on Twitter and Instagram, of course. These Three is produced and presented by me, John Wilson, in association with Analog Folk. Thanks for listening.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.